Now, why don't you let council unpack before we start, but you can come forward if you'd like. He might want to take some notes while we talk.
I'm sure he will.
Sure.
I don't see a pen. Okay. Good morning. My name is Jody Backlund. I'm here on behalf of Raymond Garland in this case. As you will recall, Mr. Garland... I reserve 3 minutes. Thank you.
Go ahead.
Mr. Garland filed pro se a personal restraint petition. The Division II of the Court of Appeals appointed us, and we filed supplemental briefing. In this case, it is our burden to show actual and substantial prejudice for various errors, and we believe we have done so. We are asking the court, first of all, for a remand.
Slow down a second, counsel. I'm
having
trouble.
Oh.
I've got a watch, too. I just...
I can keep track.
Well, we can keep track. It's just that everyone would like to know what's going on, I think. It worked fine for three cases doing what I was doing. That's what puzzles me. There, we're ready to go. What did I do wrong?
No.
All right, here we go. I'm sorry to... hope that doesn't discombobulate you.
Not yet. Again, my name is Jody Backlund. I'm here representing Raymond Garland. As you may recall, he filed pro se a personal restraint petition. Division II appointed my office to represent him, and we filed supplemental briefing in this case. In this case, we have to prove actual and substantial prejudice. We believe we have done so. We are asking the court to remand for a fact-finding hearing, or, of course, in the alternative, to simply reverse the conviction. Today, I would like to talk mostly about our argument relating to ineffective assistance of the trial attorney. Here, there were two large problems with the representation. First, the defense attorney did not convey a plea offer in this murder case that would have been of great benefit to the defendant and that he would have taken.
Counsel said she conveyed all plea offers.
She alleged that, and the reason we think you should order a remand hearing is because of the lack of credibility of that statement. We have filed with the court the visit logs from the jail, as well as the her investigator logs, as well as phone logs. And between the date of the offering that we have verified and filed with the court, the date that the prosecutor emailed the offer, and the date that the offer was rejected, there was no communication between her and Mr. Garland.
But that offer was left open.
I don't...
The prosecutor's email right before her response, have a good Thanksgiving, was, you want to accept the offer, file a motion. It was not, it expires today. Expires if you say have a good Thanksgiving or good holiday, whatever it said. And there was substantial time before trial, and the logs that you submitted do demonstrate an opportunity for communication where they met or had phone calls.
It's our understanding of the record. I agree with factually the second part of what you said, but the first part, that the offer was not rejected, is what we disagree with. Ms. Corey's allegation is that she gave him all offers and he rejected all offers, but there's no basis to conclude that in the record, and we think it's a factual issue. We have filed Mr. Garland's statement that he did not receive
that
offer.
If we view that email exchange as a negotiation that resulted in a single offer from the prosecutor, is this issue over? She said, give me this. He said, I can't give you that. She said, well, give me this. I can sell it. He said, this is the bottom line offer. If you want to accept it, file the motion. Isn't that the only offer that we have to be concerned with being communicated?
That's the only offer we are raising. I think there was, and again, factually, I know you'll look at the record again before you make a decision, but factually, it is our understanding of the record that that offer was rejected. Not that it was left open and unanswered.
When was it rejected?
I want to look at my notes and talk to you more about that in rebuttal.
Yeah, please do. Because you agree there were communications between that moment and trial between counsel.
Absolutely. I think we're the ones who approved those communications. But we believe that the time period between November 21st, when it was given, and when it was rejected officially, is there was no communication. And that's the important piece.
In rebuttal, you're going to tell us when that official rejection.
I will do that. In this case, we believe that we have proven that Mr. Garland would have taken that not only with his statement, but as well as the statement of his mother, who was played a large role in his defense, but also with simply the math of what that would have done for him. Mr. Garland had already gone through two previous trials. He was aware of the strength of the state's case against him, and to have a reduction of 10 years from his mandatory sentence, which he received, he would have taken that offer had he been given it.
What made him so wise at that point when he was not so wise before the second trial?
Experience is the only answer that I have.
I mean, he was already an experienced defendant, wasn't he?
There were three trials total.
Had some prior contact
sure.
with the criminal justice system.
Absolutely.
He wasn't a rookie.
Right. And again, going into the first trial, I think he really thought that the state did not have any evidence that there would be no eyewitnesses actually appearing for trial.
After they appeared for the first trial, going into the second trial, he still, according to all of the evidence I've reviewed, was adamant for at least a period of time that he wasn't going to plead to any murder charge.
That is what Ms. Corey alleges. And I guess I have a couple...
And he doesn't say otherwise, does he?
Not necessarily. He doesn't address it in his statements, is what I would say.
So the record would tell us that's uncontroverted.
Perhaps. I guess the comment that I have about that is, as a trial attorney, I'm familiar with many, many times when a client is adamant, the first five times you bring them an offer, but by the sixth time, for no other reason than time having passed and fear having built up, they change their mind. And so for an experienced trial attorney to take a belligerent statement of a young man at their word and never actually even convey an offer, I would say, separate from what we have proven here, that she did not do that and that he would have taken it.
Aren't the negotiations themselves actually consistent with his statement? I mean, she went to the prosecutor to try to take that very offense off the table.
She wanted a better deal, and good for her.
But it's consistent with the statement that he is on record of giving her, I'm not going to plead to murder, isn't it?
And on record
evidence
at this
that
point,
he talked to the mother because she's saying, I represent, that'll come off the table as well. That's her offer.
They want it off the table, and I would say to put so much weight on negotiating positions when you're trying to get your opponent to change their position is not necessarily merited here.
But because we don't have direct statements from him or her directly on the point you're arguing, we're looking at inferences from their other statements and conduct.
When you say we don't have direct statements, maybe I don't understand.
In the sense that we don't have direct conflicting statements of he said, I was never told of the specific offer made on November blank 2008, and she's saying, I specifically told him of that offer on this date.
I think neither. I think Ms. Corey doesn't say I told him of this offer on this date.
She says I told him all the offers.
I told him everything. I talked to him all the time.
And there's some ambiguity
yeah.
that you're arguing. All right.
Absolutely.
And he's arguing, she never told me if she had, I would have taken it. We're trying to find out where the inferences and the credibility of those statements are to see whether or not it's worth the trial judge's time.
You know my answer, which is, refer it for a hearing. I think we've raised significant issues here.
May it please the court. My name is Tom Roberts. I represent the state on this matter. The court has referred to the declarations that have been made in this case regarding the ineffective assistance of counsel claim. The dispositive issues in this case are that ineffective assistance of counsel claim regarding Ms. Corey and also regarding the appellate counsel. Regarding Ms. Corey, she specifically states in her declaration under oath that she related all offers to Mr. Garland and he rejected them. As Judge Applewick has pointed out, the email exchange between her and Mr. Penner are consistent with that. She said, look, how about a manslaughter 2? and they said no. How about a manslaughter one with a certain agreed sentence? Mr. Penner, who was the prosecutor in this case, the final prosecutor in this case, said, no, the best we can do is murder two with a firearm enhancement and assault two without a firearm enhancement, and also to negotiate there was a separate cause number that was an assault one with a firearm enhancement also.
Well, assuming that was communicated to him, should we really be skeptical that he wouldn't have taken that offer? I mean, that the 255 months, wasn't that substantially less than what he was facing at trial on the murder charge?
Well, and at trial, he was going to trial on murder one, was count one, murder two, felony murder, premeditated murder count one, felony murder count two, with a firearm enhancement, and assault one with a firearm enhancement. At trial, they got a murder two. They got the felony murder two with a firearm enhancement, and they got an assault two with a firearm enhancement. So the result was the difference was one firearm enhancement.
Well, my question was, with what he was facing as he was charged, wasn't the offer made in November 2008 a very substantial reduction in the risk
yes.
of time?
Oh, yes. Right. Yeah, the manslaughter? Absolutely.
So it was an attractive offer that would entice many people.
The state's response, what was left on
the state's response. The state's response.
255.
Right. The state's, I'm sorry.
What I'm trying to do is isolate whether or not the sentence length was the driving factor here or the nature of the charge, because it seems that the briefing intimates that the murder conviction, a point scoring, had some factor, but I don't see it developed adequately.
Well, according to Ms. Corey's declaration, she said he would never take a murder charge. He would never plead guilty to a murder. And
do we have a strike issue here that isn't been really stated, but is really what's an undercurrent?
He has a prior most serious offense, and her declaration says that he said that his consistent position was that he was not going to plead guilty to another strike offense. Well, a manslaughter would have been a strike offense, so I don't. That's inconsistent. But apparently, that was one of the motivating factors for Mr. Garland. Mr. Garland says his declaration says I didn't get any plea offers. He doesn't specify on what date. This has been brought up, I think, by Judge Applewick, on such and such a date or what have you. I didn't
get any plea offers, or he didn't get this plea offer.
He says I didn't get any plea offers. And there was only one plea offer, so I assume it's I didn't get this one. So Ms. Corey is clear, she says in her declaration.
Wait. Counsel asserts there was a 2009 offer and there was a 2008 offer, and that the 2009 was communicated.
I believe there was only one. The only plea offer I know about is the one that was discussed around Thanksgiving at the time of the third trial. Right. I could be wrong about that.
All right.
Okay. Ms. Corey says she related whatever plea offers there were. This case went to trial three times. One of the things I think that the court has to bear in mind is the very strong presumption that counsel is performing not only adequately and competently, but the counsel is doing what they're supposed to do. Ms. Corey has sworn that she has related all plea offers and he rejected them. She has sworn what his position was, not his strategy, but what his position was all through her discussions with him, that he was adamant, I'm not pleading to a murder charge. She thought maybe she could get a manslaughter charge out of the prosecutor with a manslaughter one with maybe a high sentence. But the prosecutor said, no, we're not going to do that. And she said, well, you know, he's not going to take that.
I take it, because so many of the records were described as being lost or destroyed, that we have the record in hand that a reference hearing would consider. What's the downside of asking Ms. Corey to answer the very specific questions that we're trying to infer answers to?
I don't think there is any downside. I'm not. The question really is, was the offer made? She says, yes, it was. He said, no, it wasn't. The presumption, the strong presumption that Ms. Corey was practicing properly sides with her. He has to overcome that presumption by a preponderance. Ms. Corey's declaration, her detailed declaration, I think defeats his accusation. His accusation isn't detailed. He just said, no, I never got anything.
Well, how detailed is hers when she doesn't say, I communicated this offer, I just communicated all offers?
Well, when you look at...
We're looking at a generic sentence. We're not looking at any fact-specific recital.
Well, I believe that her declaration includes copies of Appendix A of her declaration includes copies of the email exchange.
I mean, with the deputy prosecutor.
Right, right.
Wouldn't you be a whole lot more comfortable as a trial judge if somebody said, after that email exchange, on November 30th, I went to the jail and I talked with the defendant about this? Or some specific date, time frame, or even method of communication at the offer?
She said she discussed all the offers with Mr. Garland. She went to the jail.
Well, and we're back to...
Either she went to the jail or called him.
For the red lights. That's my evidence that I didn't run the red light on this particular day. It isn't, I came to the intersection, I saw the red light, I applied the brakes. I mean, there's a big difference between those two kinds of statements. I always did something and fact-specific.
Right.
Why isn't a reference hearing appropriate? And what more does Mr. Garland have available to him other than she didn't tell me this?
Well, there are... And I've responded to ineffective assistance of counsel claims where the response of the trial attorney, the defense attorney, is because I always, to use your example, because I always, what have you, whatever, I did it in this case. She's not saying because I always, with every client, I always relay every plea offer, therefore I must have related this. It's sort of like habit evidence in a trial. I always brush my teeth in the morning, therefore I must have brushed my teeth on that day. Or I always take a certain route to work, therefore I must have driven that way to work. She's not saying, I always do it this way. She said, I did it this way in this case. And she's talking about how often and how much in detail she had contact with Mr. Garland. And and I think it's backed up by the fact that, logically, that this case was tried three times, she must have had contact with Mr. Garland to discuss how these cases were going to be handled, to discuss with him, two of them were mistrials, just to tell him what was going to happen next. There were witness issues in this case, there were evidentiary issues in this case. The strategy and what have you isn't a part of this. But there were lots of things where the defense attorney would have discussed with the client in this case, and Ms. Corey says she did that. And there's nothing to say that she didn't. If the court thinks that there should be a reference hearing to flesh this out, there could be. But the issue is, did she relay this this plea offer to Mr. Garland? She says she did. I think that ends it. I would ask the court to affirm this, and thank you.
I have it all. Okay. First of all, your main question that I couldn't answer was whether or not that offer had a deadline or how we know how long it was kept open. And I don't have any answer for you other than...
No, the question was, when was the offer rejected?
Okay. My reading of the email, Happy Turkey Day to you and your family, was that closed the discussion. you read it differently, which I don't have any issue with. So I have a
reasonable person could read the offer still open after Thanksgiving.
Yes. So then what I would do is point you to the records that we provided of Bob Crow's investigation billing records. Mr. Crow has since passed, but his office provided significant detailed notes. Ms. Corey swore under oath that she only personally visited Mr. Garland with Mr. Crow present. You can look at Mr. Crow's notes up until the time of trial from all of the time that he spent. Third trial, which was in 2009. Reviewing all of his notes, he lists topics of conversations, not just who he talked to and who was there and how long it took, but he goes into topics of discussion. And reviewing those notes, you can see that there was nothing about a meeting with Mr. Garland where any offer was ever provided. So even if you don't read it as I do, and I don't argue with you on that.
In those notes, is there ever anything where Mr. Garland says what he would be interested in accepting?
No.
Okay. Well, I mean, we know there was a conversation at some point about plea negotiations, and there isn't any note about that, is there?
I want to say that I did not see that, but as I sat here
What that suggests then is that he didn't take notes of everything that was said.
That's not true. I guess what it does suggest is that as I sat there during the last 8 minutes, I only reviewed 2008 and 2009 notes to answer the other question. I apologize.
If we were to look at all of those notes and to see no discussion ever of plea negotiations, wouldn't that strongly suggest that those notes aren't a complete record of topics discussed?
No, I think it would strongly suggest that Mr. Garland's correct when he says he never received a plea offer from his attorney.
He doesn't say we never talked about plea negotiations, which would be
no, you're right.
Pretty startling in a criminal defense case.
Sorry.
That there wasn't any talk about what.
No, and I don't think you'll find that as you review it, Your Honor, and I apologize that I don't have the answer off the tip of my tongue. I can also let you know, though, in the filing that we made for Mr. Garland, he very clearly indicates he never received any plea offers. Factually, I also want to clarify, there were two offers. One was post-trial, and it related to a resolution of this case plus another case that was still pending at the time. It's not at issue in this case, but there was a second plea offer. Thank you so much. We urge the court to remand this for a fact-finding hearing, not just the issues that we discussed, but on the other issues that were raised. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.